Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're featuring three different films from the Global Green Indigenous Film Festival, which is taking place this weekend, and more about that very soon. Right now, I'd like to welcome Peter Turchi. His newest book is called Maps of the Imagination, The Writer as Cartographer, and he will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore on West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. And you are also doing an event tomorrow, which is a benefit for the Holden Diversity Scholarship. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But let's talk about your book first, Maps of the Imagination. How did you come across the metaphor of map making for the process of writing?
Came from several things, but I guess one of the biggest influences was a book by a fellow named Dennis Wood called The Power of Maps, which is really about how to read maps critically. And there's a whole field of critical cartography I know nothing about, and I knew nothing about it when I saw that book. And I realized first that it was the work of an impassioned man, and second, that there were a lot of things he was saying about what maps are and how people read them and what a lot of us don't recognize about maps when we look at them. That applies to writing and how writers work.
So, I mean, this is amazing. Reading maps critically?
There are all sorts of assumptions behind maps that you don't need to think about to read one or to use one. So, for instance, if you pick up a road map and it's a good road map and it gets you where you're going, you're just glad to have it, and you think of it as kind of an objective document.
Right.
But obviously every map that's made has all kinds of decisions behind it, including things like, you know, font size, what's included and what's omitted. And one of the wonderful things that Dennis Wood says that I've quoted in the book is that every map is defined by its omissions, because if a map included everything, there'd be no need for it. We already have the world that has everything. And so we to some extent define what we put on the page in a story too by what we're leaving out, the one story we're choosing to tell.
And so how is a story, I mean, you're a fiction writer as well as a nonfiction writer, how is a story like a map, and how is it not like a map?
Well, the first part of that is relatively easy, I guess. And anybody who's ever said that they've been lost in a book knows something about the way that a story is like a map, in that it takes you somewhere, it transports you somewhere. From the writer's point of view, you're always trying to guide the reader somewhere, even just to the end of the story, but you're trying to take them in a certain place, and you have a goal in mind at some point when you set the story down. And so to some extent, to read a story or a novel or even a poem is a journey, is to go somewhere new. And if you're excited by what you read, then you feel like you've been taken somewhere new, or you've been taken to a world you know, but you've seen it in some new way. How is it not like a map? There are probably, thousands of ways stories are not like maps. But it is true that that a story is a little bit different from many maps in that it is trying to take you to a particular place. There are other things any reader can see along the way that the author might have had in mind or might not have had in mind. But still, every writer has a goal in mind, somewhere he wants the reader to end up, something he wants the reader to understand or to see or enjoy.
I remember the moment that I first figured out that the words destiny and destination had the same root. And it's, you know, the destiny. But when you look at a map, you can take the whole thing in on some level in one glance, whereas a story is so linear. A map can take you anywhere. A story takes you to a specific place.
Yeah, well, maps work very different ways. You know, sometimes they just present the landscape. If you have the map of, say, a theme park, if you have the map of Disneyland in front of you, you can see the entire thing, and it doesn't tell you to go to one place or another. It just leaves all those options open. But then, of course, there are those maps called triptychs, the AAA triptychs, and the other maps like them, where you ask for a route to a particular destination. And there are road maps in the past. I have a picture in the book from John Ogilvie's Atlas Britannia, the first road atlas of Great Britain. And all of the maps in that book were maps of the roads from one city to another, and they were exactly for that purpose.
So you start out the book talking about two different aspects of writing that sort of map onto mapping, I guess, exploration and presentation.
Right. Yeah, there are lots of different ways to talk about how people work when they write, but certainly One useful way to think about that is that everything that happens in the first stages, which is a kind of exploration, whether it's just jotting down notes or coming up with lines of dialogue or sketching in scenes or even writing entire drafts, you're still discovering the story then. Even if you have an idea of what the story is going to be about, you're making discoveries along the way. And at some point, you become pretty confident about the story that you're telling, all the pieces are in place, and then you're really working on the effect for the reader. You know, you're deciding that you need a little more detail in some place, you're deciding that some scene is irrelevant, you're trying to hone dialogue, and that's what I call matters of presentation, where you're really thinking about how you're trying to communicate to the reader as opposed to making the discoveries for yourself about the story that you're telling. Those things don't divide quite so neatly, because ideally, even in that second stage, you're still making discoveries right up to the last minute. But it's a helpful way to think about the comparison to map making, because you've got explorers, people out in the field making discoveries and just, you know, taking measurements, and then you've got the people actually making the document.
And those people are the map makers, but you also talk about the guides. So somebody takes you into territory that's already been explored.
Yeah, every writer is a guide. That's for certain. And one of the things you learn when you start to write is that you have to be able to assume that authority. You know, readers don't enjoy a tentative leader. They want to know where they're going. They want to have some idea of where they're headed. Or if they don't know where they're headed, they want to feel a certain confidence in how they're being led.
Well, that's another pairing that you talk about, authority and humility.
Right. Right. Well, it does take some combination of the two, I think. Humility in the sense that you have to be open to revision, open to changing your vision for what you're doing all the time, because if you're doing things well, you make discoveries along the way. But also certainly authority, because every reader enjoys being told a good story. One of my colleagues, Rick Russo, the novelist, has written a lot about the omniscient point of view, which he says is largely lost among a lot of young writers today.
What's going on with that? I've heard people talk about that. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a certain distrust of that voice of authority. You know, we might accept it from Tolstoy. We might accept it, even from certain characters in Shakespeare. But now I think we're all struck by the individual point of view and competing points of view. And so writers might be a little more tentative about assuming that all-knowing voice. But it's still a wonderful device, and obviously readers enjoy it, you know, by witnessing all the books in the omniscient point of view that people still enjoy.
Well, I wonder also if the multiculturalist movement that says, you know, there's no one authority that can speak for everybody. You know, everybody has their own point of view and everybody has their own story and their own culture and stuff, and you can't talk about anybody else's that much has affected it as well.
I'm sure that's part of it, and it's probably a combination of a kind of political sense of whether it's appropriate to assume that kind of authority, but also I think it's directly related to the whole movement towards psychological realism and trying to inhabit the individual point of view, and the notion that, I mean, that really has been dominant for a long time, trying to pursue one character's view of the world. And, people still find refreshing and enjoyable that voice that will stand back and will say things like, there once was a very old woman, a very old man with three beautiful daughters. You know, kind of an old-fashioned voice which makes assertions which are not going to be questioned and which has a story in mind.
And a map, I suppose, is an omniscient point of view in the sense that the map maker has told you what's in this territory.
Well, that's one of the really enlightening things about the Dennis Wood book, or it was for me, which is that a map assumes a certain authority, but of course there are decisions being made all along the way. I have in the book a copy of a map of the United States. It's made by the Raven Map Company. It's a beautiful map. And it purports to be an objective map, as most maps do, a scientifically accurate map. But in fact, it shows us a view of the United States that no human being has ever had. First of all, there are no clouds over it. There are names written on it. It's flattened out, so of course there's a distortion involved. All the things that are typical of just about any purportedly scientific map. But there are always distortions, there are always slight misrepresentations, and then there are always the choices of the mapmaker about what kinds of information to include. So every map is deeply subjective.
It's funny, that it reminds me of a conversation that the author David Foster Wallace had about dictionaries and liberal and conservative dictionaries and how many different choices go into defining words and what words are standard and so on.
Right. Always. Well, I mean, if you go back to Johnson's dictionary, you know, one of the most famous ones, Samuel Johnson's dictionary, I mean, it's just the most subjective, personal document. It's a wonderful book, but It certainly puts right on the surface the fact that a dictionary involves a lot of an author's or editor's choices.
We're talking to Peter Turchi. His book is called Maps of the Imagination, The Writer as Cartographer. Now, I wondered, how was the book itself, your writing of the book, a demonstration of the cartography metaphor?
Oh, well, that's sort of interesting. I started to write not a book but a lecture. I'm the director of the graduate program in creative writing at Warren Wilson College, which is in Asheville, North Carolina. And it's an odd program. It's a low residency program, which means the students and faculty come from all over the country and even outside of the country for 10 days to North Carolina. And then they go back home, and we work one-on-one the rest of the semester. And
by email or whatever?
Now it's by email. Used to be by mail. And then as faculty, we give lectures or classes at that residency, and often we approach fiction writing and poetry writing in unusual ways. People have talked about camouflage. People have talked about all kinds of interesting things. So I gave a lecture about writing and mapmaking, and I thought that was pretty much the end of it. But then I gave that lecture again at a writer's conference, and an editor there asked me if I'd considered writing more on the topic, and I said no, and I put it away. But it started to kind of gnaw at me, and so it started to work its way out, and it really was a matter of sort of recognizing that there was more unknown territory out there. I started to think about different ways the metaphor applied, and then started to examine them at greater length. And so the book grew out of very much a sense of exploration and discovery, because I never knew how much more I was going to write about it, and I didn't force myself to write a book about it. I was just writing about what interested me.
Well, and it's a wonderful book. First of all, it's beautifully printed and bound, and it has wonderful maps and illustrations in it. That must have been part of it, is just making this sort of sensuous document.
Yeah, I wanted a lot of illustrations in it from the start, for obvious reasons, I guess, but I was lucky to come across a press and an editor, a poet named Barbara Ross, who was completely in sympathy with the project, and so was willing to spend a lot of money on the book. A fellow named DJ Stout out of San Antonio designed it, and he's won a great many design awards for the book. Last count, I think he'd won 8, including he got a silver medal for most beautiful book in the world. From a club in Germany.
Really?
That decides that. Yeah.
That's great.
It's a gorgeous book. But one of the ideas was to try to make it look a little bit like a 19th century geography textbook. And I actually wanted it distressed and square and to look exactly like a geography textbook. But my editor wisely said no, because that would have been very expensive. But they did use a font, and they did distress the cover in certain ways that brings that to mind. So it was a lot of fun to have a book that was that pretty, too.
Yeah, the font and the feeling of it made one feel like this was, I don't know what, elementary school 80 years ago or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you always tell people don't judge a book by its cover, because usually as a writer you're disappointed in the cover your book gets. But in this case, I'm happy for people to pick it up and judge it by its cover.
There's a saying, map is not territory, and that's actually the name of a music program on KSFR.
Oh, really?
that airs on Tuesday evenings. But there's a great quotation, which I wish I had marked, by Oscar Wilde, talking about the difference between life and literature, life and art, and life itself is so unfinished and so unwieldy, whereas when you make a piece of literature or a piece of or a map, suddenly there's boundaries and coherence and meaning to the whole thing.
Right. Part of making a poem or a story or a novel is to find order and shape, and that always involves a certain kind of reduction and just perceiving a shape out of things that, you know, are more or less chaotic. A story is also like a map, though, in that, you know, the words on the page imply certain things for the reader, but the reader, of course, brings his or her own experience to the reading as well. So while the writer might have a very clear vision of what the narrative does, every reader is going to picture things a little bit differently. Readers may interpret things a little bit differently. And, of course, your cultural reference points and your own background say a lot about how you're going to interpret any given piece. So the writer makes a suggestion by holding the map out, and then the reader reads it however he or she will.
One thing that I've often thought about, which is an amazing phenomenon of being a reader, is that within the first couple of minutes of the first page, you have an entire movie set, you have an entire landscape or picture of a house or a place in your mind that is far more detailed than what the author gave you.
Yeah, I guess it depends to some extent on the text and to some extent on how you read. You know, I'm one of the most naive readers. I never anticipate. I don't look ahead. If I'm guessing what's going to happen next, I know there's probably something wrong with the book because I tend to just receive the information as it comes. Whereas my wife, who's a huge Dickens and Trollope and Henry James fan, she's always thinking about the shape ahead and anticipating what's going to happen. And often she'll read, you know, the 80th Trollope novel and just chortle to herself because she can see exactly what's going to happen. But that's not the way I read, so I think that's part of the individual experience.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, map making, is map making something that every culture does?
Every culture does in some way, although somebody out there would be quick to point out that Native Americans and Aboriginal Australians don't make paper maps, and they don't offer maps to outsiders. Aboriginal Australians have song lines, so those are oral. Marshall Islanders made maps out of sticks and shells. Native Americans certainly mapped things, but they didn't have documents. Some made documents when white settlers and other people came over and asked for them, but they didn't make maps the way we typically think of them, although there are examples of maps on hides that they created later. But every culture certainly does map its way through its territory, and sometimes they do it what we might say scientifically, focusing on land and features of the land. But other times they're mapping aspects of their culture or their past. In Moby Dick, Melville has a line about the stories told about the whale, and the line is, this is a close paraphrase, the ocean was storied with his deeds. And the notion is that, you know, the place itself has stories laid over it. And so that kind of map making has always happened.
Would you say that, you know, having done this book and looked at so many different stories and kinds of maps, that you can tell something about the stories of a culture by the kind of maps they make?
I don't know. That's a good question. I should think about that, but I haven't tried to correlate the two. I'm sure there is, though, because there's something about the way you try to understand the world around you, the way you make sense of it, and so it would make sense that there'd be some correlation.
We're talking to Peter Turchi. The book is called Maps of the Imagination, The Writer as Cartographer. Would you like to read a little bit from the book?
I'll just read the very beginning, which tries to establish, no, it does establish the metaphor. There are lots of epigraphs in this book, and this one begins with a quote from Emerson. The writer is an explorer. Every step is an advance into new land. The earliest extant alphabetic text, the earliest extant geographical maps, and the earliest extant map of the human brain date back to the same general period, around 3000 BC. While no one can say for certain when the first writing and mapping occurred, the reasons for recording who we are, where we are, what is, and what might be haven't changed much over time. The earliest maps are thought to have been created to help people find their way and to reduce their fear of the unknown. We want to know the location of what we deem life-sustaining, hunting grounds and sources of fresh water then, now utility lines and grocery stores, and life-threatening, another people's lands, the toxic runoff from a landfill. Now, as then, we record great conflicts and meaningful discoveries. We organize information on maps in order to see our knowledge in a new way. As a result, maps suggest explanations. And while explanations reassure us, they also inspire us to ask more questions, consider other possibilities. To ask for a map is to say, tell me a story.
Peter Turchi. So is one of your hopes that this, I mean, you were doing a creative writing program in North Carolina. Do you sort of have a hope as part of this that it will help writers, especially young writers, think about their work?
This is for old writers.
is it?
In a way, yes. The lectures I gave were for graduate students in this program, and they're fairly advanced writers, of them. They tend to be in the average age in the program is mid-30s, 36 or 7, and many are older. It's not an introductory text. It's not about how to learn to write scenes or dialogue or anything
right.
like that. It's a book for people who have read those kinds of books and who have been writing for a while and are interested in thinking about writing in different ways. I think it's unusual to think about blanks and silences as an important component of writing, but that's one of the chapters in this book. There's an entire
And that's
chapter.
A wonderful thing, blanks, and you have blank parts on the page and so many different kinds of discussion of what's left out and what's silent.
Yeah, both our former poet laureate Louise Glück and, of course, the Russian short story writer and playwright Anton Chekhov have said in different ways that the most boring work is the work that tries to include everything, and they make an argument for work that withholds. So I think considerations of issues like those are not the first thing that come to mind when you sit down to learn to write. So I don't really mean old writers, but I mean writers who've been thinking about writing for a while. That was my intended audience for the book, although oddly enough, I end up talking to design students, and I spoke to a group of software designers. Various people seem to find the ideas in the book relevant to what they do. A choreographer the other day asked me if I had choreography in mind when I wrote it. I know nothing. I can't dance, so nothing about choreography.
That's so interesting. Well, there's so much. The book is so rich with ideas and images, and also, I mean, your love of literature and of learning imbues the whole book, which is great. There's so many quotations from and references to literature. It sounds like it was really fun to do.
I didn't restrain myself about the references. So there are certainly works, references to canonical works, and then there's some of the, I don't know, people usually call them postmodern writers who I admire, Calvino and Borges and Nabokov and Robert Coover. But then, you know, there's also a section in there about game boards and how they use space and how they represent places. And then there's a short discussion of Roadrunner and Coyote and Chuck Jones's creation of their world and the rules for that world. And it's great fun. Whenever I go to a talk and I show that image, people usually respond with a kind of glee because they don't expect, you know, some of the cartoons to come into the story. But it is fascinating that popular fiction, whether it's a network TV show or a cartoon or even a Hollywood film that usually has so many constraints placed on it, is those pieces are often much more formally defined than the average literary novel.
Very interesting. We're talking to Peter Turchi, and he will be reading tonight from his book and signing books and talking to people at Collected Works Bookstore on West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe at 6 o'clock. And then tomorrow there is an event from 5:30 to 8:30 at the William Siegel Gallery at 540 South Guadalupe. And this is a benefit for the writers program at which you teach.
It is. Yeah, as I said, our students and our faculty are all over the country. A number of them are right here in town. And we have this scholarship fund, which has brought all sorts of writers who might not otherwise be able to pursue their writing education to the program. And we're working to endow that scholarship. And we usually try to have as much fun as possible doing it. So, you know, we'll get together. We'll have a good time. There'll be, I think, four short readings. We'll tell everybody what that scholarship is about. We'll see some beautiful art. It should be a good night.
And if anybody has more questions, they can call Collected Works Bookstore at 988-4226. That memorized. I hope that's correct. Peter Turchi, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's been my pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking about the Global Green Indigenous Film Festival. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Jeremiah Bitsui. He is part of the Global Green Indigenous Film Festival, which takes place this weekend in Santa Fe from Friday to Sunday, April 18th through 20th. And he is in a film called A Thousand Roads, which is screening on Sunday, the 20th of April, at 3 o'clock at somewhere. Where's your film screening?
Actually, the whole schedule for any of the films, too, they can go to ggif.com.
GGIFF.com, Global Green International Film Festival.
It has a whole schedule for all the films.
I will figure out where it is because I did write it down somewhere. But anyway, so let's talk about this film. It's a relatively short film. It's 40 minutes. It's produced by the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian. And it's made up of four fictional stories about Native people in various places, New York, Peru, Alaska, and then your section is here in New Mexico. Tell us about your character, Johnny Chi.
My character is... It's interesting because I quit acting when I was about 14 years old.
You quit acting?
Yeah, I was in a movie called Natural Born Killers. I was doing pretty good, landing commercials. I got offered another film with Regency, and it was another movie with Woody Harrelson. It was a lead role, I didn't get it. It broke my heart, and I just quit acting. And it was at a time in my life where I just wasn't really stable, just in terms of knowing myself. And so this character was very significant because I was getting in a lot of trouble. I was losing friends to violence.
Now, the character is a gangster in Albuquerque.
Exactly.
Who we see driving in a car and coming up to the side of another gang car.
And it was pretty ironic because, I mean, at the time I was living in L.A., not really with any intention of being involved in the motion picture business, but just of going to school. At that time what happened was I read the script. I knew Chris, the director, and I went into the Mandalay offices up in Wilshire, and met with them, met with the whole producing team, the director, and it was just really ironic because a lot of these things were similar to, you know, things that happened in my life. There was actually a point in my life where I just couldn't leave my gun, and my mom just said, whenever, for the better of your life, you know, this is not the direction you need to go. I'll let you make your decisions. You're basically a man now, and so you need to figure out how you need to live your life.
That's very, in a way, very brave of your mother to say to you, you're a man, you make your own decisions, when you're still a young person living in her house doing something that's pretty scary.
I was really pushing to try to get out of school. I knew that I'd probably have to, I knew I had to get out of there and just kind of get out of that environment, you know, inside my heart. Instinctively, I kind of knew I had to get out of that environment and go live somewhere else and start something different. And I was almost done with high school at that time. So it was just shy of that I ended up getting shot. And so it changed the way
that I
thought.
You got shot?
Yeah.
Good heavens.
And so it changed the way I thought, changed the way I looked at everything. Ultimately, I started, doing things different, going to, did better in school and just wanted to get out of there. Ended up moving to L.A., going to community college, graduating, and then this film came along, and it was right at a time when I was writing something, a movie, and a screenplay, and it was just kind of like this fell in my life, and then right after that, I was in Lords of Dogtown, Wildfire. There was just a lot of movies that just kind of started coming my way, and so since then, I've been just acting again.
So your character in the film A Thousand Roads goes to what they call in the film Navajo boot camp.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
I wouldn't say there's a traditional Navajo boot camp. Not like it's something an institution within our culture or anything.
Right.
But it's. I think I understand that, you know, with Navajo parents, one thing that was threatened is you're going to go and you're going to have to stay with your grandparents. Because it's away from everything, away from computers, your TV, everything. So it's not really it's not that fun, you know? And for my grandparents, they're similar to the grandparents in the movie. My grandparents are sheep herders. So that was very similar, and I think that I could definitely identify with that because they get up with the sheep, they sleep, everything is based around the sheep.
And there's this wonderful moment in the film where your character, Johnny Chi, is listening to hip-hop on little white headphones, and the sheep are bleeding all around him, and you're just the contrast between those two sounds is really kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a certain detachment that you can see in the film in terms of his character in this environment, where it's almost like, not that the environment's not accepting him, but he's not really accepting the environment. And, you know, as you're, like you're saying, it's just kind of him versus nature at that point, and the crow takes his headphones.
The crow takes his headphones. It's so great. So the film has in it actors like you. I mean, you are a trained actor, but there's also people who are not actors who are just cast because they really were like the characters in the in the film.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance. I didn't have a chance to go to the premiere in Washington. I was working on something else, but my parents went, and they said, "Oh, that girl, she's Dawn. You know, the young girl
in Alaska.
You know, the girl that played Dawn. She's like, oh, she's just such a wonderful girl, and she's I totally see why she could get casted. And if you watch the special features on the DVD, you'll actually see some of the casting processes that they went through.
I know. I watched last night. It was very interesting because, for example, they went to Peru and they wanted to film a Peruvian healer. And so they just got a bunch of healers and auditioned them. And they were all very humble and they fully understood what was going on. And so it's sort of a strange thing because they reenact a healing and the guy is doing what he actually does as a healer, but it's just a kind of dramatization of it.
They wanted everything to be really authentic. I've seen it posted several places online where it's listed as a documentary.
Right, which it totally is not.
Yeah, which it isn't, but it's interesting because there is certain parts of each person's life that it does feel like you know, I think that was an important element to them, to the production team and the directors.
So
being able to have that reality.
The Global Green Indigenous Film Festival, okay, this is at the cinema. Your film screens on Sunday, A Thousand Roads, at the Cinema Cafe.
Cinema Cafe.
Which is the Santa Fe, which is the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive, and it's at 3 in the afternoon. Now, Joy Harjo was a co-writer on this film.
Yeah.
Did you get to work with her directly?
I just met her at Sundance.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I wondered if you had input into the writing of your scene since it was a character that was really so close to your own life.
Yeah, I mean, I think one compromise that I had when I decided to start acting again was that these are characters that I'm creating. When I did Natural Born Killers in my first movie, I thought that, you know, it's important what you put out in the world, and it's so important to be able, artistically, you do have an obligation to make sure what you're putting out is something that you really believe in. And so for a lot of that, I'd stick up for it, and I still do, you know. I've had the privilege of working with great actors since Chris Eyre, and our great directors and other great actors, and no matter the caliber or whoever, you know, not to have any type of attitude about it, I just try to defend my characters, or I try to say, this is what they would really say, you know. And there was some of that to where it was just like, I don't know if he would say that, you know, or could we do one for me and just kind of try it more through the action, physical action.
Right. Know? Well, Jeremiah Batsui gives a marvelous performance in the film A Thousand Roads, which screens at 3 o'clock on Sunday, April 20th at the Santa Fe Film Center. And for more information about the Global Green Indigenous Film Festival, you can go to ggiff.com. Jeremiah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. And I want to plug my our youth workshop. We work a lot with kids, and we're going to be doing a youth workshop that the GGIF is sponsoring.
Oh, great. When and where?
That's going to be this Saturday, and it's going to be from 8 to 2. It's going to be at the CCA. But if they could, if people could pre-register, Candace Costello is going to be taking the pre-registration, and she could be reached at 505-216-7681. That's 216-7681.
Excellent. Thank you so much for letting us know about that, too.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be talking more about the film festival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome us, joining us by telephone, Steve Michelson, executive producer of the film Oil on Ice, that screens at the Center for Contemporary Arts on Saturday, April 19th at 8 in the evening. It's part of the Global Green Indigenous Film Festival. Welcome. Hello?
Oh, I don't know where Steve went, Mary Charlotte. Let me try to get him again.
Okay, well, we'll just talk about the Global Green International Film Festival, which is happening at various locations throughout Santa Fe.
Hello.
Okay, there you are.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Your film, Oil on Ice, has been called the best documentary on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. How did it come to be made? Tell us that process.
Well, it's an interesting story. Dale Girasi, who was the producer and a neighbor of mine when George Bush first came into office and started talking about drilling in the refuge, he said, well, gee, I really ought to go up there and see what's going on, what it's like. So he took a rafting trip right through the refuge and brought his friend Beau Boudard, who turned out to be the co-producer of the film. And so it really started with that rafting trip in 2001, essentially, right after Bush had taken office. And it just grew from there. The more the more the talk was and the more we found out, the more we realized this was a very bad idea.
Well, and it's interesting because here is the film screening in the Global Green Indigenous Film Festival, and there's a very strong Indigenous perspective on this whole idea of drilling for oil in the wildlife refuge. Tell us about the Indigenous response to this.
Well, on that same rafting trip, Adeline Peter Raboff came along, who was somewhat of a friend of the family, and Adeline is a resident of Arctic Village, the northernmost outpost in the United States, in Alaska. It's just below the Arctic Refuge on the other side of the Brooks Range. And, you know, that began our relationship with the Gwich'in Indians, who are a 10,000-year-old culture that live in that area and revere the caribou as their sacred, sacred wildlife that they both live with and live off of in a very sustainable kind of a way. And they knew, their elders have prophesied, and in fact, during the process of us making the film, they created what they called a gathering of all the Gwich'in from both the United States and Canada. The actual refuge spans both countries. So it's even more complex than most people would think, because decisions the United States makes affects Canada and vice versa, because the caribou roam between the two countries. And so, the Gwich'in have a very, very strong belief that this is sacred land. This is not land you drill on. It turns out that the exact area where they want to drill is the calving ground for the caribou herd. This is a caribou herd that's an extraordinary, it's the largest remaining herd in North America.
Now, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is relatively small compared to the vast territory around it where oil, in fact, has been drilled. What is it like in places where oil has already been drilled?
Well, if you listen to the government, they'll say, well, the caribou are doing very well there, and they'll show you beautiful pictures of caribou grazing alongside pipes, and in fact there is another herd that has actually done well, but apparently there are some problems that I've learned from the Gwich'in, that they just there is an effect upon them. They aren't breeding as well. In our film, there's a quote from a scientist saying that if a caribou who's about to give birth sees just one drilling rig on the horizon or one drilling system, on the actual Arctic plain, they will disallow and remove themselves from that place. So you pretty much are looking at the removal of the herd. Of course, they can go elsewhere, but there's not a lot of elsewhere to go on that plain. It's a pretty small area, but when you take a look at the size of the herd.
It's interesting, too, because there are some really sort of horrifying clips of politicians saying, we don't want to conserve. Conservation is a really bad idea. But the film brings out the relationship between the amount of oil in that area and the amount of conservation that we're capable of doing.
That's really the saddest part about the current administration, is that Dick Cheney, at the very beginning of his energy policy briefings, he came out saying, well, conservation should never be part of an energy policy. It just won't work. It's not American. And Trent Lott certainly echoes that in the film. We can't imagine asking people to do less. It's not the American way. And George Bush Sr. says something to the effect of, to a world meeting in South America, the American lifestyle is not negotiable. These are no longer true statements that we can follow. This is not leadership. So, the amount of oil that's available at the current rate in which the world is consuming it, is a drop in the bucket. There's maybe 6 billion barrels of oil available, and it won't be available for another 10 years. So for us to actually go and drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it really won't have, I think the experts have calculated that it'll have like maybe a 1% factor. It's no solution, it's the bottom line.
This film was made in 2004, and it's sort of striking how far we've come since then. What has happened politically since your film was made?
Well, probably that's the most interesting thing. People have credited this film, and it's important to see it because twice during the process of distributing the film, the Arctic Refuge, if you recall, came up for a vote in the Senate. And Alaska's Senator Ted Stevens, who actually wrote the legislation, he was a lieutenant of Dwight Eisenhower in the 50s to protect the 1002 area of the, and you learn all about this in the film, this one particular area where the oil is and where the caribou calve, that's the area that only an act of Congress can legislate. And so twice during the last during this administration, that vote has come up. And at the 11th hour and 59th minute on the last, you know, during those times, we had over 500,000 people visiting our website for information and for action opportunities to email and send faxes and letters to their congressmen. We have a powerful toolkit that enables people who don't even know who their congressman is to take action by just putting in their zip code. So we were given an enormous amount of credit for actually creating citizen action along with, we had quite a few, we had 14 different NGOs involved, including the Sierra Club and a number of others, Alaska Conservation Foundation and many others who were supporting this. And we were positive. I mean, at the time that these votes came up, the Republicans had majorities in the Senate and the House, and we were absolutely positive that this was a lost cause. And at the 11th hour and 59th minute, as I say, a group of, I think, 36, what they called themselves moderate Republicans, under the pressure of their citizens and constituents, voted to honor what the polls had already said. The majority of Americans do not want to drill there for all the reasons that are described in the film. So this was this came about that the Bush administration was not able to drill. They were not able to get the majority of Congress to agree to go ahead with the drilling. And what's important right now is that there is yet another bill. It's sort of the last dying bill.